Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. We continue our series on the subject of textual criticism today, getting a lot of positive input, a lot of positive responses. Gotten any nasty King James only emails? I didn't think so. You hadn't mentioned any. People ask me, you know, these people writing and getting mad at you, or these people writing and getting mad at you. And so that's good to know. That's they must not be listening.
Maybe they just don't know what to say.
It's possible.
It'd be a first.
The prerequisite being that they have to have something to say in the first place has not been our experience in the past, is it?
Well, no, it's not being, they always have something to say.
Yeah, but
whether or not there's any merit to it, whether or not it's irrelevant, but they always have something to say.
Oh, man. Wasn't there a guy calling you the past couple of weeks? You know, why are you attacking the King James Version?
Well, he's been calling me for 3 years.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So, no, I finally sent him past.
I know. I understand that. I'm just saying that it does happen. And, that's not how I wanted to start, but that's okay. Hopefully you have downloaded the documents on the website. And please keep the website open as well, because I have some graphics there that I want you to look at. If you are listening by archive, you will find the documents, Lord willing, the blog articles for, let's see here, this would be February 6th. There's some there. Just go from February 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, around in there today, looking at some in the 7th range, so on and so forth. So just look in early February 2007, and you should find what you need to be able to follow along. If you have a United Bible Society's 4th edition Greek New Testament, you can go along as well, and Nestle Allen 27th edition. I even have, there's my Textus Receptus sitting here. And did you know you're on the webcam today? Yeah, you're on. Everybody's looking at you today, and he's waving at everybody at the webcam. There you go. Just keep that in mind in case you do this number, because that people will save that, load it up to my family. It's really bad. And so the lights go out. Yes. So much. Now there is a shadowy figure in the background. That's good. That's all rich. All right. If you have gathered all of your materials together, and I hope you all are enjoying the videos, you can tell I recently got the software I needed to do video capture and to pull down. Not only, you know, I've had these videos for a long time, obviously. It was just doing the transfer stuff that was a bit of a challenge. But now DVDs, VHS players, last night I conquered the real media thing that was in my way. And so now we're going to be dangerous. No two ways about it. We're going to be very dangerous with these things, because I think it's much more effective to listen to someone saying something and then respond to it than it is just to read, well, they say this and here's my response. And I think people will find that to be most useful. Just recorded two more clips that I'll put up later in the week, and so on and so forth. But anyhow, last week we were looking at, if you're looking at your UBS text, we were looking at a variant. We were using the variant at Luke chapter 23, verse 34, as sort of a baseline. Now, obviously, it's also an important variant for those of you who weren't with us. Just a brief recap. The phraseology, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, is a textual variant. And what we're doing right now is we are looking at the various signs and symbols that you will find in the UBS 4th edition. Then we'll go over the Nestle Allen 27th edition. And how to read that information. That information has been provided to you. in the critical editions of the Greek New Testament. And I think it's really nice to have a critical edition of the Greek New Testament. One of the points that I made in my debate with Shabir Ali is we don't have a critical edition of the Quran. One hopefully someday will be made, but we can't do that right now. And I think there is a very important point to be made at that juncture. We want to find the earlier and earlier manuscripts of our scriptures, but not a whole lot of Roman Catholics necessarily. Roman Catholics. see, that's what happens when I start reading the channel at the same time I'm trying to talk. Not too many Muslims want to do that. So anyway, we had just gotten to the point of basically starting to look at the variant, but then I realized, well, wait a minute, need to back up, and we need to talk about sort of the canons of textual criticism, and that's with one N, not with two. That is the general rules and regulations. When you look at, for example, the variant not in in Luke 23 there, but let's look at UBS2.pdf. It's the one that I uploaded just last evening or sometime around that time for you all. It also is from the UBS 4th edition, and it is pages 812 and 813. It provides you 1 John 2:22 through 1 John 3:10. And let's look at two of the variants that are found here just to give you an idea of the practice of textual criticism. We're not going to go super in-depth here. We're going to look at a number of different variants. We'll be able to pick up some of these canons as we're looking at variants. But basically, what you need to try to do is to reconstruct in your mind the process whereby hand copying would take place. This morning I was heading home, and I couldn't help to start thinking about the fact that we even struggle today with my generation, Rich and I's generation, and the next generation. For example, when I talk to my kids about what it was like when I was in high school writing reports, that was BC, before computer. And my kids can't even begin to understand what it would be like to type a report on an IBM Selectric. They can't even figure out what it would be like to try to leave room for a footnote, to leave that spacing in there, what correction tape looks like. They have no idea. They've always had computers. And so for them, copying out of a book, you could use a scanner to do that. When I was in college, you had to have the book, and you had to have it where the typewriter was, and you had to be sitting there typing away. And what would happen if you skipped a line? What would happen if you messed up and forgot where your footnote was supposed to go? You had to start the whole page all over again. And they look at me and go, wow, how'd you people live before computers and microwaves? How'd you ever get anything done? You must have been up from morning till night and stuff like that. So I'm just demonstrating how elderly we are becoming. But anyway, we have to try to get way farther back than my IBM Selectric. But I did have an illustration there. I would have to sit there and I would have to be very careful in copying. And I wrote some big papers when I was in high school. I remember writing a 52-page paper on evolution when I was in a public high school in my sophomore year. And so I was doing a lot of copying out of books, these long quotes and stuff like that. And you had to be very, very, very careful while you're doing that. But I'd still make mistakes. And I remember the mistakes because it would cost me so much time and it was so costly to, you know, rip the page out, look where you were, restart the whole thing. And today you just go up and insert, put it in. Well, the problem is this is the first generation where you've been able to do that. And so the parallels, it was actually easier years ago to talk to people about scribal errors, mistakes that you make while copying from something, an open book, a piece of paper, whatever. It was a little bit easier to illustrate those things back in the days when there was still more of a connection. Now with computers, we can just, you know, move the cursor, stick things in. If you misspelled something, it's underlined in red, and it suggests what the correct spelling is. Sometimes it'll just correct it for you, and you don't even realize you're misspelling it. It corrects it for you all the time. We have a guy who must use that a lot in channel named Whistle. actually, I think his spell corrector melted. It committed suicide. As the first word program that ever just refused to start because he was going to use it. But anyway, today people struggle with that, but we still have to illustrate these things because when you were copying from another manuscript, let's go back in time here. You do not have fluorescent lights. You do not have a climate-controlled environment. You do not have nice things to write on. You do not have nice things to write with. Now, we're talking about the earliest period here, but even once you had scriptoriums, even once you had all of that kind of stuff, still you didn't have LASIK. You didn't have glasses. There were a lot of, you were copying by candlelight or sunlight or whatever it might be. So there's all sorts of those issues that go in. And then remember, what you're copying will always have been handwritten. Now, I know that handwriting is almost a completely lost art today, is it not? I mean, my cursive is horrible. My printing is not half bad, but I prided myself on that when I was in school. But anymore, does anybody?
You just need the right font.
You need the right font. Yeah, exactly. It looks really pretty. That's just it. There weren't fonts back then. And so you would be copying almost always what someone else had written, and very frequently it would be someone who's no longer around. So you can't take it over to their office or to their cell at the monastery or whatever and say, what is this? I can't read your handwriting. How often do you have to go to people today in your office? What in the world did you write on this thing? I can't understand it. You get a fax or something. Something's handwritten on the bottom. You can't understand a word it says. I got a letter from somebody. Beautiful cursive writing. But it was so fancy and so distinctive. Just got it this week. I could not hardly make out a single word of it. I mean, I could only make out one or two words, had a general idea sort of what it was about, but there was all sorts of stuff. I simply couldn't read it. It was too pretty. So these are just some of the things that go into the background that lead to the constructions of the canons of textual criticism. What does that mean? Well, what scholarship has discussed and continues to discuss to this day, one of the reasons that there are differences of opinion, that people will take readings in different ways. That's why we need a critical edition of the text, because, you know, sometimes people say, I don't agree with the committee. I want to know what the committee rejected. I want to know what their reasoning was. I want to know what the other evidence is. That's what's such a blessing about having a critical edition of the Greek New Testament. At least I'm not having to do what Muslims have to do and think Uthman got it right the first time. Can't tell you why he did. Don't know what he was choosing from, but I just have to believe he got it right the first time. I don't want to, put that kind of trust in somebody else who doesn't even claim to be inspired. So with that in mind, scholars look at how human beings copy manuscripts and the kinds of errors that they make. And that observation of human nature then becomes the foundation of the general rules that you examine. Now, obviously, when you examine any variant, you have internal evidence and you have external evidence. What's the external evidence? The external evidence is the manuscripts. It's the hard evidence. It's what the manuscripts say. Now, as we have discussed, sometimes that's difficult to say. Sometimes the manuscript's difficult to read, or sometimes you'll have a manuscript that's very, very helpful to you, but then when you come to one particular verse, there's a hole, you know, bugs ate through it over the years, that page fell out or whatever. Or sometimes it's just smudged. I mean, this is leather, folks, and you can understand how letters can be smudged and age over time, and, you know, someone spilled some coffee on that page or something like that, if they had coffee. And whatever scribes drank to keep them going. Because, man, copying manuscripts was not easy, by the way. There are things called colophons in especially the medieval manuscripts, where scribes would make notes at the beginning and ends of books. And one of the common colophons was the end of, as a traveler rejoices at the end of his journey, so I rejoice at the end of this book. And think about, I mean, you're not talking about a couple hours here, folks. We would start complaining just horribly if we had to spend 10 minutes handwriting something. We'd put our pens down and we'd rub our poor little aching hands and can't I get a scanner or something like that? You know, the OCR, man, optical character recognition. Woo, that's the greatest thing ever designed by man. These people would spend days and weeks copying these books. And so you can imagine the backaches and everything else that went along with it. And when you're not feeling that good, what is really very, very amazing is how excellent the New Testament manuscript tradition is, not that there are variants in it. It's amazing that it is so pure, given all the opportunities there were for really messing up in making copies of copies of copies. So when you keep that in mind, there are certain rules that in general come into play. You look at the external and the internal evidence. The external evidence is the hard evidence. It's the evidence given to you at the bottom of the page there. It's what the manuscripts read and when the manuscripts are written and so on and so forth. And that's the external stuff. Internal evidence would be what you are able to derive from looking at the text itself and what would be the best way. I don't know how that happened. I know how it happened. Dell support struck again, and it's not even plugged in. Isn't that cool? Everyone now knows I've got a Dell laptop in front of me. Yes. Anyway, I've got to turn that silly thing off. I just haven't found a way to do it. It doesn't like to turn itself off either, I assure you. Anyway, let's just look at this as an example. Look at the page 813 of the UBS 4th. It is the first variant noted at the bottom of the page, and I am going to blow mine up just a little bit here to about 150%, so it's a little bit easier to see. And you will see up in verse 2. Verse 2 says, "Beloved, now we are the children of God, and it is not yet manifest what we shall be, but we know that when he is manifest, we shall be like him, because we will see him as he is." This is a presentation of what Christ is going to be like and our relationship with him. And, of course, the variant is in the preceding verse. Right before that, it says, "Because of this, diatuta, ha kosmos u genoskai hemas, hati uk egno auton." And that is talking about the fact that this is because this world does not know us, because it did not know him. Why is that? You go back one more line, and you go to the very beginning of chapter 3, verse 1. "Behold, what great a love the Father has given to us in order that we might be called," hina technotheu kleithomen, "in order that we might be called the children of God, kai esmen, and we are. Because of this, the world is not knowing us, because it did not know him." Now, right next to, that's the very first line on page 813, you will see the little superscript letter 1. And it's after the word esmen. Now, this one you can track without a Greek New Testament. Why? Well, if you'd like to follow along, if you've got your Bible nearby, if you have a King James or a New King James, turn to 1 John 3:1. Or if you have basically almost anything else, if you have the New World Translation of Jehovah's Witnesses, repent. If you have the Joseph Smith version, ditto. We're not going to be worrying about mistranslations and purposeful perversions and things like that at this particular point in time. But if you have basically almost anything else, did I say the letter one? Okay, the number one, sorry. I'm reading off a PDF here, and it wasn't allowing me to get where I wanted to go. It just did not want to load properly, unfortunately, so we were having to play around with it. Anyway, if you look at that particular passage in the ESV, NASB, NIV, any of the translations that are modern translations, you will see that the phrase, "and such we are," is there. For example, if you look at the New American Standard, it says, "See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us that we would be called children of God, and such we are." ESV, "and so we are." All of it is right there in front of us. But if you have other translations, like the New King James Version, it's not there. That phrase, and such we are, and we are, is not to be found there in that translation. Now, is this, you know, some sort of conspiracy on the part of the New King James and the King James to hide the doctrine of the adoption of sons and so on and so forth? No, of course not. There is a difference between the TR, the Textus Receptus, and the modern critical texts at this particular point in time. And in this instance, and this is somewhat unusual, in this instance, it is the modern texts that have a phrase that is not found in the TR. Normally, that's the other way around, because one of the canons of textual criticism is generally scribes tend to conflate and expand, not delete. So generally, the shorter reading is the better reading. Generally. There are exceptions to that rule, obviously, depending on context and other reasons, and this is one of those exceptions, and we'll see why. Now, when we look at it in a regular Greek text, we might not immediately be struck by why it is that scholars can be so very certain. And I would argue, honestly, this is one of those texts where you can really find out if a King James-only advocate is a King James-only person or is a really reasoned person. Because this kind of error is very easy to recognize and very easy to see. What do I mean? Well, if you go back to my website, if you go back to the blog, and if you go to the entry that I made yesterday called Another Document for Today's, actually, I guess it was this morning, Another Document for Today's Textual Critical DL, well, it was supposed to be this morning, but our clock is on the website is an hour off now, ever since the time change. So I posted this about 12:30 in the morning, and it thought it was 11:30 last night, so it's off one. It's ever since the time change, but hey, the time's going to go back pretty soon here anyways, who cares? Anyhow, 2007, you've got a nice pretty graphic from Codex Sinaiticus there. And then I provided you with three lines of Greek text. Now, if you can't read that, that's because you have not installed the proper Greek font. And if you go down to the bottom of the blog, there is a link to BibleWorks, and you can install the proper Greek font so that almost all the time, unless I'm posting something that came from an old book where I'm still using the Mounts font, especially an older Mounts font, that's not going to work. But most of the time, you'll be able to read the Greek on my blog if you'll install the proper fonts on your system. I gave you three lines of unsealed text. And remember, as you see in the graphic, the ancient manuscripts are written in unsealed capital letters, as we would call them today, without spaces between them, words break between lines, etc., etc. And it's not nearly as easy to read as our modern text. The first line gives you what 1 John 3:1 would look like in an unsealed text. And for most of us, it's like, okay. And then the second line, what I did is I gave you the important aspect of this text, which is the Greek term kleithomen, which means that we should be called, and then the Greek term kai, which means and then the verb esmen, we are. And so you see, kleithomen kai esmen, they're all run together in the darker red of the second line on the blog article. Then the third line, what I gave you is the reason why we have a textual variant here. The term kleithomen ends with mu epsilon nu, men. That would be similar to one of our words ending with an ing or a t-i-o-n or an e-s. These are common endings in the English language for various forms of words. And we see ings and t-i-o-n's all the time. I mean, our minds don't even see them after a while. They're just factored in as we read. And what we're looking at here in 1 John 3:1 is a classical error called homoiteluton. Homoiteluton, which means similar endings. And here's what happens. You're a scribe, and you are writing along, and you are writing the word clathoman. And you have just written mu epsilon nu. And now your eye goes back to what's called the exemplar, what you're copying from. And since you just wrote mu epsilon nu, your eye's going back to look for what you just wrote to continue on from there. But there's a problem. It's very easy for your eye to find the next mu epsilon nu, which in this case is the last three letters of Esmen. And so if your eye goes back and you see that mu epsilon nu, and you don't even have to be overly distracted for this to happen, especially because in this case, the grammar continues to be correct. There's nothing, it doesn't become gibberish. Sometimes when a scribe make an error, the result would be gibberish. But sometimes a scribe can make an error and the result isn't gibberish. And sometimes when we're copying, we don't actually go back and reread what we were writing. When we do, sometimes we go, what on earth did I do? But very frequently, let's face it, even in today's age, we're in a hurry and we don't go back and proofread. And so if you see similar endings, what happened is an early scribe writes clathoman, his eye comes back and he sees the men at the end of chi esmen, and so he just goes on from there with diatuta. And because of this, the world does not know us because it did not know him. And two words have been deleted inadvertently. There's no conspiracy here. There's nobody going, oh, I don't like this idea of adoption into the family of God, so I'm going to get rid of it. No, nothing like that at all. Instead, it's just as if we were writing and we wrote ing, our eye goes back, we find an ing right afterwards, and we continue on and don't even notice that the error that we made. That's what happens at 1 John 3:2. And so when you look at it in UBS2.pdf, you might not necessarily see that just by looking at the text. I mean, you can see mu, epsilon, nu, but there's a comma and a space and another space and things like that. Remember, that wasn't a part of the original text. So when we look down at the variant listing, you will note that they put in parentheses an A, which means we are the committee is certain that we have here the proper reading. Chi Esmen, notice it says P74 vid next to it. P74 is difficult to read at this point, and so sometimes what happens is if a portion of the one column is missing, they can still go, all right, if it was there, it would have taken up about this much space, and they can tell by the column that's still there basically how many letters were in the missing portion, see? And so they can, even if the side's missing and you can't look at the manuscript and say, yes, it had it, or no, it didn't, sometimes they'll be able to say, well, if it didn't, then this line would have started up here someplace. There's too much space there that it had to have been there, in other words. And so they cite P74 and say that, can't tell, but it seemed to have had it. Then Aleph, A, B, C, you can see a whole list of minuscules and unsealed manuscripts that contain this. You also have lectionaries and the Latin, the Vulgate, and the Syriac, and the Coptic, and Ethiopic, and Georgian, and Slavian, and Augustine, and so on and so forth. And then, under the omission, you have 1175, the Byzantine text, including unseals K and L, some lectionaries and a few manuscripts of the Vulgate. So, again, if we were to just count this, I didn't look at this. I'm going to get out the majority text. Those of you watching on the webcam, here is the majority text right there. And I have a feeling. Let's find out here. I didn't look at this beforehand, but this is live webcasting, so I can go ahead and look at it. Yep, they do not have it. They have the note in the bottom. You can see Chi Esmen at the bottom. That's one of the advantages of having this. But it's the Egyptian versus majority text. So that's a a very clear distinction between the Byzantine text type and the Alexandrian text type in having that phrase there. Now, this to me is one of the texts that demonstrates the secondary nature of the Byzantine text type. Evidently, what happens is early on in the area around Byzantium, one of the important manuscripts, maybe K, maybe L, that become the prototype of the Byzantine text platform, this simple scribal error takes place and nobody notices it. It then becomes the predominant reading in that one particular area. This is why I reject the majority text type reading. Because it results in enshrining what is clearly a scribal error as if it is the actual text itself. You see? So, this is called homoiteleuton, similar endings. And that's, an excellent example for you. Now, another kind of error is an error of pronunciation. Now, there are different errors of sight. For example, similar endings could also cause you to skip an entire line. Because if you had mu, epsilon, nu on the next line down, you could lose an entire line. But normally, when that kind of an error would take place, that would really stick out. That would almost always result in a real mess. Something really didn't make any sense anymore. And when you encounter a text that doesn't make much sense, there's probably been an error. Though, one of the other canons of textual criticism is the more difficult reading is more likely the original reading. Why? Well, because later scribes didn't like difficult readings. Later scribes like things to be smooth. If the scribe himself didn't understand it, then he might think, well, someone must have made an error here. And so that factors in many times as well. But after the peace of the church, it's called the peace of the church, when persecution against Christians ended, the scriptures could be copied within what was called a scriptorium. Now, in a scriptorium, it could be done a couple different ways, but one of the ways we know it was done was you would have one person sitting up front reading the text, and then that person is going to be going at a, you know, going to be doing a small chunks of text at a time, and then you have copyists sitting at desks who are listening to him, and they're writing down what he says. Now, obviously, if they have a question, they can raise their hand. They can say, what's the spelling on that, whatever it might be. But generally, this is the way you could make more than one copy at a time. You would have to read it out, and it would have to be hand-copied by 1, 2, 3, 10 people at the same time. And then, hopefully, in the better scriptoriums, you would then have people who would do read-throughs and cross-checking and so on and so forth. But what does that raise? That raises not just errors of sight or errors of mind. Now you have errors of hearing. How many times have you been listening to someone? And even, you know, Sunday morning at church, you just have the greatest desire to listen carefully. And frequently it's something that's been said that it sparks a thought in your mind. And all of a sudden you basically wake up 3 minutes later because you have chased that rabbit off into the woods someplace. The pastor's now way down the road, and you've been sitting there like a zombie. You've become distracted. Well, that's, you know, distraction is a part of the human experience, shall we say. And so not only that, but sometimes people have accents. Sometimes people don't speak all that clearly. Ever gone through a drive-through, perhaps? Ever gotten to the window, and when they read back your order, you go, eh? What? Or you have no clue what the other person is saying because they don't actually speak English or something like that, you know? And so there's all sorts of reasons why this could happen. Now, when we pronounce, when I was reading, for example, when I look at, say, verse 28 of chapter 2, Kai nun technia menete anauto hina ion phanerothe skomen parisian, et cetera, I am using a pronunciation called the Erasmian pronunciation. It goes back to Erasmus. It is an artificial pronunciation. We well know that John would not have pronounced everything the same way I did. A lot of it, he probably would have figured out what I was saying. But especially when it comes to the vowels, the Erasmian pronunciation differentiates between each of the vowels so that when I'm saying it, you can tell what the word is. But we can tell, mainly because of scribal errors, that in the ancient world, when Greek was still being spoken, and obviously scriptoriums and hearing errors would only be relevant during the period of time when people would still understand enough Greek to write it, which means it becomes irrelevant in other areas fairly quickly. But we can tell that the differentiations that I make between certain vowels and diphthongs, they did not make. So on the other page of that same scan that I gave you, UBS 2, there is a variant in verse 25. And actually, if you go through UBS text, especially 1 John chapter 1, you'll find this kind of variant over and over and over and over again. And that is the difference between pronouns. And the pronouns you and us, the first and second plurals, for example, I pronounce the text in verse 25 as hamin, because I've been taught to pronounce the eta as a long vowel and the iota in a certain way. And then the other variant, this is down at the bottom of the page in the variant at verse 25, this is 1 John 2:25. I would see the second variant, which is found in B 1241, 1292, and a few others, as humin. The difference is between hey and who. I differentiate between the pronunciation of the upsilon and the eta. That's how what I was taught to do. That's what I'm comfortable doing. And when I'm reading to somebody else, they can make the difference between the two. It seems that in the ancient world, they were just both imin. Imin. They sound the same. Or could be easily confused with one another. Or the genitive form, umon. Imon. And so we frequently have questions in regards to especially pronouns. Is it so that my joy might be, that our joy might be fulfilled, or that your joy might be fulfilled? That's not like that exactly. It makes a huge difference, but there are common textual variants where the two could be interchanged, and many manuscripts show the difference between those two. They look alike too. So it could be an error of sight, but probably that one, given its commonality, actually comes as an error of hearing within a scriptorium. All right? So, errors of sight, errors of hearing, errors of mind. Another of the errors of mind to keep in mind, and I didn't provide this, and I don't want to leave anybody completely out in the dark here, but I knew there was another text I wanted to scan, and now all of a sudden, middle of the program, it hits me. My apologies, but I think it is important enough to at least mention it. And that is in I can scan it and upload it to the same thing. When people listen to the archive, they can pick it up. So, all right, if you're listening live, wait a few hours and I will scan this one in and attach it to UBS2, and I'll update that file. And so when you pull it, you can pull it back down, and all will be well. And for those of you listening on archive, you won't even care that I said any of this, because it'll be all there anyhow. So I'll just do this out of the text. If you go to what will be the second page. technology's fun, isn't it? Man, you couldn't do this when we were on radio. You know what I mean? You had one shot, and that was pretty much it. What will be the scan of Ephesians chapter 1. I'll tell you what's in Ephesians chapter 1, but it'll be from Colossians chapter 1. And this will be, this is called doing it on the fly here. Is this not going to show it? Oh, this could be interesting. Well, that's interesting enough. In Colossians chapter 1, you have a humos versus hamos variant in verse 12, which is what we were just talking about. There it is. Colossians 1:14. And I'm going to have to find another UBS text, because I have my entire text underlined in Colossians 1, so that's not going to look good. But anyway, that's still readable. In Colossians 1:14, some of you, in fact, I think you were around, Rich, if I recall correctly. We were at the south gate of the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City, and this big tall guy came up to us. This was obviously many, many years ago. Probably about 1995 or 96. Maybe as early as 94, but probably 95, I'd say. This big tall guy comes walking up to us, and he's passing out tracts to Mormons. That probably indicates he's not a Mormon. But he comes walking up to us, and he's been passing out tracts. He's been watching us doing our thing for a while, and finally he comes up to us, and he looks at me, and he says, "So, do you use the Bloodless Bible?" Now, we've run into some odd things outside the gates of the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City. But I knew exactly what he was saying as soon as he said it. I could tell by his demeanor. I could tell by the look. I knew what he was talking about. And he was talking about this text. See, King James only advocates say the NIV is the Bloodless Bible. They've taken out the blood. And if you will compare Colossians 1:14 in the King James, the New King James, with the New American Standard, NIV, and others, you will see that there is a difference in the reading of the text. The King James has, "In whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins." The New American Standard, NIV, says, "In whom we have redemption, even the forgiveness of sins." And so they say, see, those people are offended by the blood of Jesus. They've taken out the blood of Jesus. And I tried to reason with him, and I, you know, once in a while I've had some success, but I said, well, you know, it's funny you would say that, because as we know, Colossians is parallel in many places with the book of Ephesians. And if you look at Ephesians 1:7, you have a very similar phraseology in Ephesians 1:7. And there, in all the manuscripts and in all the translations, it says we have redemption through his blood. So if the New American Standard, the NIV, so on and so forth, were ashamed by the blood, why didn't they take it out of Ephesians 1:7? Instead, what we have here is what I have, what scholars have identified, what I called in the King James only controversy, parallel corruption. Parallel corruption. Scribes functioned a lot like King James only advocates. They wanted parallel texts to read identical to one another. And in fact, when you look at the Gospels, I've been teaching through the Synoptic Gospels, and if you look at the Greek version, the Synopsis Quattro Euangeliorum, which provides you with textual data from, I think that's Nestle-Aland 25 or something like that, but it provides you with textual data at the bottom of the page. Almost every time there is a substantive difference in the phraseology and the wording in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll find some scribe someplace trying to change their manuscript to make them all harmonize to one another. Almost always. Now, normally it's just one or two. That can be purposeful. Or, like this one, it doesn't have to be purposeful. And you might say, how could this not be purposeful? Real easy. Ephesians 1:7 is a part of the liturgy of the ancient church. Blessed be the God and Father, in whom we have redemption through his blood. And if you happen to have memorized Ephesians 1:7, or you happen to be familiar with a liturgical phraseology that uses Ephesians 1:7, when you're copying Colossians 1, and it's a shorter version of the text, totally inadvertently, without purpose or malice or anything else, you can just simply see the phrase, in whom we have redemption, and I've done this while typing at the keyboard. I'm sitting there, and I'm conflating passages, and oh, in whom we have redemption through his blood, and I look back, oh, it doesn't say through his blood. But that's just the way your mind works. That's what you're used to hearing in the church. Same thing. Good example here is the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer in Luke is much shorter than it is in Matthew. And yet, the Lord's Prayer is a part of, almost anybody who's a Christian can say the Lord's Prayer. And so when you're copying Luke, if you're not aware that it's shorter, it's going to be real simple for you to start expanding stuff even without trying to. And so when you look down at the bottom of the page in Colossians chapter 1, it actually sort of surprised me that they included this as a variant. I think they only did so because of the fact it's in the King James, it's in the New King James, people can make a problem about it. I actually was surprised they included it because there's such little attestation of the reading that's in the King James Version. If you look at this on page 686 of the UBS Fourth, it's the second variant listed. It again is given an A. And there's this long, long list. And what should cause you to go, whoa, this is odd, is not only do you have Aleph and A and B, those dreaded, terrible, horrible Alexandrian manuscripts, but then you have BYZ, KLP, lectionaries. The lectionaries are almost always Byzantine. The Vulgate, Syriac, Coptic, all these early church fathers. I mean, it's everybody, including the majority text. In fact, I'm going to double check myself here before, you know, you make one mistake when you're going, you know, I'm not even using notes as presentation. All I've got is what you guys have got. I'm doing the rest of it off the top of my head. And if I make one mistake, that's all people ever look at. Page 605 of the majority text does not have through his blood in verse 14. So even the majority text people must have produced a bloodless Bible. No, they're just going with the text. The vast majority of texts, including all the ancient texts, do not have this phrase. So where does it come from? Well, whenever you see in the UBS or in the Nesyalon a parentheses C and then text, parentheses close. So you have C, Ephesians 1:7. That's their way of telling you this is a parallel corruption. This is a phrase that has come over here because of the parallel text elsewhere, which is similar, by the way, once we finally get back around to it, the text in Luke 23. But anyway, then you have 1, 2, 3, 4 minuscule manuscripts. The earliest 424, that's not the date, that's the number of it. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lectionaries. The Clementine Vulgate, which again is very late. One version of Syriac, Armenian, Slavic, and a couple early church fathers, well, early church. And again, as soon as you get to the fathers, there'd be the exact same impetus in, especially here. Oh, man, this is excellent. I hadn't even thought about this before. Think about this with me. This is an excellent example of the limitation of the usefulness of patristic sources for textual criticism. In other words, the early church fathers, they're important in some ways, but there are certain kinds of textual variants that the evidence really just cannot come near having the same thing as manuscript evidence. Here's a good example of it. Why? Because everybody who listens to this program regularly knows what text I'm about to parallel this with. What if you today tried to reproduce the text of Matthew 23:37 based upon radio preachers and Arminians and Dave Hunt's newsletter? The phrase, "and your children," would be deleted from the text because no one ever remembers to quote it right. Dave Hunt can't get it right, and Norman Geiser can't get it right. My goodness, we've heard R.C. Sproul miscited because he's not looking at it. It's just you're doing it by memory. And so that's exceptionally common, especially in preaching. We all do it, and we'll conflate things. And especially when it's a text like Colossians 1:14, it sounds so much like Ephesians 1:7. I bet you if we start digging around, we could find so much evidence of good, solid teachers who have miscited Colossians 1:14 and added in, not because of the King James, but because of the parallel to Ephesians 1:7. So the same thing is here when you see this listing of early church writers and you see Cassiodorus or you see Gregory of Nyssa. Does that mean that the manuscript that Gregory of Nyssa had of Colossians, did he actually write in his writings, Colossians 1:14 reads like this? Or is this just simply a citation where we go, well, I think he was in Colossians there, but he might have been in Ephesians. You know, there's no way of knowing. We can't tell. Or is it, in this case, for a deletion, is it just that Gregory of Nyssa stopped and didn't finish quoting the whole verse? See, that's where, when you see these things, you can't just automatically jump to the conclusion that, oh, since this person's name is listed here, that means that the manuscripts he had in his possession actually contain these words. It is very common to see non-specialists and people who just don't know what they're doing in the internet throwing stuff like that out as if it is an absolute established fact. It just has to be there. See, and so keep that in mind when you see that kind of thing. But you have just a small handful of late manuscripts, and in my recollection is the earliest of these that I could find was the 9th century. So you're talking 9 centuries after the time of Christ is the earliest that you can find this reading. It's in a literal handful of manuscripts from 1,000 years after the time of Christ, and yet it's in the King James Version, and a true King James onlyist will defend it till their death. That who cares if no Christian for 1,000 years had ever seen this reading? It doesn't matter. It's in the 1611 King James Version of the Bible. And you might say, well, how'd it get in there if it's in just a couple of these? One of those minuscules was used by Erasmus, is my recollection. I don't remember which one it is. I think it was 2464, but I'd have to check that. Going off the top of my head again there. Don't have any notes in front of me. But I think one of those was one of them utilized. And Erasmus only used between 6 and 12 manuscripts anyways. But it just so happens that one of the later ones, and it's ironic, Erasmus had one minuscule, a pretty decent minuscule text that dated back to about 1000, but he distrusted it because it was unlike the other ones he had, which were newer to him, but were actually farther removed from the original. And so that's another little fascinating aspect of that. So, Rich, don't let me forget to throw those scans in there because... I've got another. I think I've got a UBS 4 someplace that isn't all marked up. So yeah, we'll just make sure to throw them into the same one so that people can open just one file, and it shouldn't make it all that much larger, and that'll make it easier for folks to take a look at. So with that, in the last few moments here, let's finally get to the UBS variant here and sort of try to apply some of the thinking here, so you can just get a taste of why scholars come to the conclusions they do, and how blessed we are to have the information. So if you go back to UBS.pdf, page 1, the one we've looked at before, the question is, what about the phrase, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. We know that this is not found in the Synoptic Gospels outside of Luke. So this is not something you find in Matthew, it's not something you find in Mark, it's not something you find in even John, outside the Synoptics. And so where did it come from? Well, a lot of folks would agree with, you found them. You found my cupcakes. Doggone it. I just looked up and found Rich eating one of my cupcakes. Do you know they have no sugar in them? That's Splenda, man. You know, I hope none of that gets on any of the keyboards in there. If our whole system shorts out because you're eating those cupcakes, Matt found them. Oh, great. Wonderful. Are there any left? That's the question. I'm going to have to find a better place to hide things. Well, it's a live webcast. Anyway, many people, sorry about that. We'll have to cut that little element out when we post the program. Notice on the second line, it says, include verse 34a with minor variants, see Acts 7:60. A lot of people would say that what you have here is not so much a parallel corruption as it is a recognition that Stephen, when he is being stoned, says, do not hold the sin against them, forgive them, etc., etc. And there would be many who, scribes, who would have a concern that a martyr could express such a phrase, such a thought, while Jesus does not. And that this is where the phraseology comes from. Now, I would point out that Jesus, the early church, prays in Acts chapter 4 and recognizes that what has happened to Jesus has happened at the direct predestining will of God, that Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles, they did what God's hand had predestined to occur, and that Jesus was not like Stephen. Stephen did not give up his life. Jesus had the authority to give his life and to take it back up again. So there, theologically, there are issues to be addressed there. But let's look at the evidence very quickly. The evidence is only the verse is omitted in only a certain number of manuscripts. And for a lot of people, what they don't like is, all right, let's say there are, again, we'll use a round number, 2,000 manuscripts that contain the Gospel of Luke. And it's in the vast majority, so why even care? Well, when P75, when your earliest manuscript of a book doesn't contain it, and then the first unseals show either that they don't contain it or show a recognition of a variant at the text, that text already. And why do I say that? Because look at Aleph 1. First line of the variant, first page, UBS.pdf, the line that starts with the little 5, then the bold 34A omit verse. You've got P75, it's papyri manuscript 75, does not contain this. This is the earliest manuscript of Luke that we have. Why wouldn't it have it? When we look back up at it, we go, well, wait a minute, what about Homo Italiotan? Nope, there's nothing there that would give us any reason for Homo Italiotan to exist, anything like that. That would be a pretty long phrase to lose due to Homo Italiotan. Okay. Then we have Aleph 1, which means it's originally in Aleph, but then the writer of Aleph recognizes that it's not supposed to be there, and so it's marked out. And B doesn't have it at all. The original hand of D does not. Washingtonius does not have it. There are, Theta does not have it. There are a number of, 070. And what you could do if you want to do a complete and full study of this is you look at each one of these manuscripts, you look up the date, you look up its provenance, what's its textual characteristics, so on and so forth. You know, if you want to do a really in-depth study, that's what you're able to do. Then you have early translations. Part of the Boharic of the Coptic, the Sahidic, certain of the Old Italian, Old Latin, I'm sorry, does not have this particular verse. Why? You have to ask yourself the question, why would there be a deletion that has this kind of distribution to it? Then you have the inclusion of the verse in a wide variety. Well, obviously, the vast majority include the verse. It's there. And then, interestingly, notice at the very end of the variant, include verse 34a with asterisk E. So the writer of E knows that there are variants to this text. He knows that this text is questionable. Now, what do you do with that information? Well, I think we should always make it known that many ancient witnesses, especially translations and writers, included this phrase. But I think one of the wisest conclusions we can come to in regards to textual variants is that you don't base an entire theological point on a textual variant. Now, if this is a textual variant and the same phrase occurs elsewhere in the scriptures, that's different. That's a different thing. But in this context, where this is the only witness, and it's not included by Matthew, it's not included by Mark, that's a different thing. I think that there should be concern concerning the utilization of this phraseology, this particular verse. But let's face it, folks. When was the last time you heard anybody referring to this particular phrase and mentioning its textual variant? I've never heard it mentioned in the sermon. Not once. Not once. I think the vast majority of people who preach on it just aren't aware of it. Should be. It's rather important. So anyways, we're out of time for the program today. Obviously, we will be pressing on next week with the textual criticism series and hopefully moving on to the Nestle All-In Text and then eventually taking your calls with your questions about text here on the Dividing Line. We'll see you later.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.